A rally supporting health care reform in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 4th of September. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, more bad news for salmon fishermen in the state, this time on the Tanana River.
Obviously, the run is very weak this year, one of the lowest on record.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
Congress returns next week from a month-long recess, during which members heard plenty from their constituents. With a lot at stake in health care and energy bills, interest groups have been extremely active, almost with the intensity of a political campaign. Alaska hasn't seen as much incivility as some places have, but still the pressure on the state's two senators has been high. APRN's Steve Heimel reports on a rally held last night to give the senators a send-off and a message about health care reform.
Both sides of the health care debate have been accused of astroturfing the town meetings and rallies aimed at influencing the process. Astroturf is the slang term for protesters or demonstrators who are in the pay of an interest group. But while those interest groups may be playing a role in Alaska, most of those at the rallies have appeared to be reflecting their own strongly held views. In this case, the group was Organizing for America, which has two Obama campaign workers still active in the state, and turned out a decent-sized crowd at an Anchorage middle school. Outside of renting the school, the group's biggest expense was probably pre-printed signs and stickers handed out to the participants. It certainly wasn't the PA system or the cell phone, which was held up to the microphone, so the crowd could hear Democratic Senator Mark Begich calling in from Indiana on the route of his weeks-long family road trip across the country. Begich told them he's all for health care reform. The crowd already knew that, of course, but was well coached to deliver an answer to the senator through the cell phone on the stage.
Senator Begich, thank you for supporting health insurance reform!
They also had a chant for Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, who was not there or calling in, but says she favors a piece-by-piece approach to reform. Organizer Jonathan Teeters also asked Begich for his position on the public option, the idea of a government health insurance entity that would compete with private health insurance companies. Begich made no commitment on that, allowing us how that's where the real battle will be, and the crowd was ready for that answer.
We support the public option!
Quietly interspersed among the health care reform advocates were some who have been active in Anchorage's Tea Party rallies against big government and what they call Obamacare. They were just watching, one with a small camera, in much the same way some of the pro-reform forces show up for the Tea Parties. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A case of the H1N1 influenza virus, also known as swine flu, has been confirmed in a student at Sitka's Mount Edgecombe High School. At least 40 other students at the state-run boarding school are also reporting flu-like symptoms. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The students' symptoms last about 24 hours and are similar to regular seasonal flu, says Mount Edgecombe Superintendent Bill Hutton. They include a fever of around 100 degrees, along with head and body aches. About 400 students attend Mount Edgecombe. Hutton says with that many people in close quarters around the clock, keeping the illness at bay can be a challenge. Still, school officials are isolating students until well after their symptoms subside.
After another 24 hours of being fever-free, they've been coming back to class. So they've been kind of out of class for 48 hours and feeling lousy for 24.
Mount Edgecombe has been consulting with state public health officials on how to proceed and has a medical clinic on site. State epidemiologist Dr. Beth Funk says swine flu has been circulating in Alaska since late May. Her office gets information on the severity of the disease from the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control.
That both of these agencies are saying that it appears that H1N1 influenza is acting very much like regular seasonal influenza. So it's not more severe, it's not a more deadly strain at this point in time, but no one really knows what's going to happen in the next week or the next month or as the flu season progresses.
Health officials urge everyone to use common sense hygiene practices. That includes washing your hands frequently and thoroughly and blocking your coughs with a sleeve or tissue. The seasonal flu vaccine will soon be available. Funk says that vaccine should be considered for infants, children, the elderly, and those with chronic health problems. Although the seasonal vaccine does not protect from the swine flu strain, it may protect from other strains that could pop up this season.
Crystal balls don't work very well with flu, and so you just kind of have to think of all the possibilities and try to plan as best you can.
Funk says the swine flu vaccine will likely start coming into the state in small amounts beginning in October. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Former Governor Sarah Palin's communications director, Bill McAllister, has been cleared of charges that he used his office and position to help Palin's political activities. An investigation into the complaint by Anchorage's Andrew McLeod said, quote, "The evidence reviewed to date does not demonstrate conduct that violates the Ethics Act." McAllister says he always looked at his job performance as ethical and within the scope of his job description.
There was no predisposition on my part to look for ways to campaign for the governor. I was trying to facilitate her job as governor, including setting up interviews for her at the Republican National Convention prior to the time that she was picked by Senator McCain, when she would have had ample opportunity to talk to the national media about issues such as Anwar. And so I had lined up interviews with Newsweek and USA Today and so on.
During and after the national campaign, McAllister says he focused on Alaska issues and on speaking for Palin in defense of her job performance. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a campaign to end hunger in Anchorage.
Kids get a snack after school, put food in their bellies, and it's sad to say, but sometimes that's the last meal that those kids are going to eat until they see us the next morning.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
Salmon fishing restrictions have gone into effect on the Tanana River due to the poor Yukon fall chum run. Commercial and personal use fishing are shut down, and this week the state began limiting subsistence fishing. Regional Commercial Fisheries Supervisor John Linderman says the restrictions reflect an exceptionally poor Yukon fall chum return that's now moving into upriver tributaries like the Tanana.
Obviously, the run is very weak this year, one of the lowest on record. It's actually looking like there's a minimal amount available even for subsistence uses.
The subsistence harvest on the Tanana is being limited to 2 28-hour periods per week in an attempt to ensure enough fall chum make it to spawning grounds. The fall chum run coincides with a silver salmon run that travels as far upstream as the Tanana. Linderman says silver returns are strong and helping make up for some of the chum deficit on the middle and lower portion of the Yukon.
Coho abundance is at least on par, if not slightly above, fall chum salmon abundance, and that's typically not the case. So because the coho run is so good, but the fall chum salmon run is so poor, we are still allowing for some subsistence opportunity. But we've reduced the amount of time available for subsistence by about a third.
Linderman says it's unclear why the fall chum run tanked. The primary parent class of fish are from 2005, which was a strong run. Some suspect too many of those fish were allowed upstream. Linderman says that can be a problem.
If you have a limited amount of space within a specific tributary, and then you have a very high abundance of salmon that would be coming in and utilizing that spawning space, you may get waves and upon waves of salmon that are coming in and spawning and respawning in the same areas, then you may be pushing out some of those eggs that have already been deposited. But that doesn't necessarily always translate into a negative. Sometimes it can have a neutral impact.
Linderman says it's hard to nail down a single cause for a weak run, and it's more likely a combination of factors during the salmon's life cycle. As of September 2nd, 223,000 fall chums had moved past the state's counter on the lower Yukon, well off the average 659,000 for the date. Coho Passage was 193,000 fish, substantially above the 142,000 average. It may be nearing autumn, but Juneau just got a little greener. 11 years after design work and permitting began, the local electric utility on Monday flipped the switch on Phase 1 of the Lake Dorothy Hydro Project and boosted its hydropower capacity by 20%. Officials with Alaska Electric Light and Power invited reporters to visit the site yesterday, and Sutton went along and filed this report.
From Juneau, it's about a 20-minute helicopter ride to Dorothy Lake, tucked back among the mountain goats along the east bank of Taku Inlet. 3.5 miles long and the color of copper patina, it's the highest and largest of three lakes whose waters cascade down a craggy gorge to the beach. Engineer Scott Willis has a job title for this pristine mountain lake.
It came to my mind earlier this week that Lake Dorothy is a diesel avoider, a diesel preventer.
Diesel's not just dirty, it can be expensive. Juneau residents became acutely aware of the cost twice in the last 2 years when avalanches cut off power from Juneau's main hydro facility at Snettisham. The town was forced onto backup diesel generators at a time when fuel prices were sky high. Willis says it would have been a different story if Lake Dorothy had been online.
When I'm running Dorothy full blast, that will offset about 30,000 gallons a day of diesel. But I figured that if we had had Dorothy during the first avalanche, we would have used 40% less diesel. So it's a significant amount.
AELNP's long-term plan is to build a tunnel directly from Dorothy Lake to the powerhouse, but that would provide more power than Juneau currently needs. So they built a shorter tunnel, tapping Dorothy about 140 feet below the surface, and put what Willis calls a faucet on the end. The tunnel's not in use now because water's spilling over naturally.
We want to have water going down in the wintertime, so we tapped Lake Dorothy, put a faucet on the end of that, and when we want water in the wintertime, we'll open that faucet and water will cascade down this same waterfall into Louis, into Bart. And at Bart Lake, that's where we pick it up. We put a small dam at Bart Lake, and that's where our penstock or steel pipeline that's going to go all the way to the plant, that's where it is. So we just use the natural flow of the lake down into these lakes, and we pick it up at Bart. And that gives us the amount of energy that we can effectively use here in town and resulted in a project that was easier for us to pay for than if we had come all the way.
The project's construction cost totaled about $70 million, more than $20 million over what was expected when construction began in spring of 2006. Project engineer Corey Hildebrand says a lot of problems were unforeseen. They had to halt work at the powerhouse while eaglets fledged in a nearby nest, and bad weather forced delays at remote sites.
Fuel costs went up just when we were building. Material prices went up. Give you an idea, when we estimated the job, the transformer cost about $200,000. When we bought it, it was almost $680,000. Copper prices just hit the market at the wrong time.
Utility customers will pay for the project. The company will file for a rate increase next spring. President Tim McLeod says it could amount to a couple of cents per kilowatt hour. But he says Lake Dorothy will greatly reduce the need to use diesel generation, and that will keep rates down over the long term. Completion of the project is good news for Greens Creek Mine on Admiralty Island and Princess Cruises, who purchased surplus power from the company and will now suffer fewer interruptions. McLeod says the project would not have been financially viable without the Greens Creek connection.
The Greens Creek thing was really almost a miracle to Juneau. It's something that utilities don't normally have, that kind of a load to help with these projects.
There wasn't a lot of fanfare when the project went online this week. Hildebrand says they shared a little cognac, but the company is planning a formal dedication this spring. In Juneau, I'm Ann Sutton.
A Canadian mining company is searching for a large copper deposit in a mountain west of Ketchikan. Exploration has begun on the Mount Andrew project and could continue for some time. It's one of several Canadian mining ventures active on Prince of Wales Island, including one focusing on uranium. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Prospectors first dug into Mount Andrew more than 100 years ago. They found some gold, silver, iron, and copper, though not enough for a sustainable operation. Several companies have tried to find profitable amounts of ore since, without much success. Rob McLeod of Full Metal Minerals says his company thinks it's worth another try.
It's a historic prospect. In fact, some of the first claims ever staked in Alaska after the U.S. purchase were staked out there, and there's some historic mines. So the old-timers pulled a fair amount of copper out close to surface through underground and some glory holes. So we're seeing if there's anything that looks exciting at depth.
Full Metal Minerals plans to spend about $200,000 on this fall's effort. The Vancouver, British Columbia-based company has already done some exploration at the mountain. It's near the village of Kasan, south of Thorne Bay.
Last year we did some drilling with some encouraging results. We'd like to see some higher-grade copper, so that's why we've decided to use this geophysical method called induced polarization.
The method uses an electrical grid covering the area where it hopes to find copper. It sends a low-voltage current into the ground. A device connected to the grid then shows where there may be large deposits. Another exploration effort is going on at the Niblack Prospect, a copper, zinc, gold, and silver deposit about 30 miles to the south. The CBR Gold Corporation of Edmonton, Alberta, recently announced plans to resume drilling at the site. The company's Derek Iwanaka says preliminary results show good deposits of gold, and that's not all.
The copper and the zinc particularly have a very high grade, and the interval itself is quite large. So following up on that is going to be quite important for us.
CBR Gold recently partnered with Hunter Dickinson, a Vancouver, British Columbia firm that's also involved in Western Alaska's Pebble Mining Project. More exploration is underway this fall at Bokan Mountain, another 20 or so miles south on Prince of Wales. UCOR, based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, is drilling at the site of a uranium mine that closed nearly 40 years ago. Steve Burrell of the Alaska Miners Association says the firm is interested in the radioactive ore, as well as what's called rare earth elements.
Those are the metals that are required for lots of different things to do with solar panels, with high-efficiency automobiles, with high-efficiency electronic circuits. And those metals are mostly received right now from China.
Only one major southeast mine is in production, Greens Creek on Admiralty Island west of Juneau. It will be followed next year by the Kensington mine north of the capital city. In Juneau, this is Ed Schoenfeld.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
At a noon gathering in Anchorage's town square yesterday, the Food Bank of Alaska launched its September Hunger Action Campaign. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In her introduction, Food Bank of Alaska Executive Director Susanna Morgan pointed to two clusters of small flags stuck into the grass behind her.
We have 83,000 people in Alaska that access food assistance from a food pantry, a soup kitchen, a mobile food pantry, a senior center, a youth program every year. These flags here behind me, each one represents 1,000 people.
Dave Barney of the Mountain View Boys and Girls Club doesn't need flags to understand hunger in Anchorage.
Throughout the school year, we participate in their snack program, where our kids get a two-component snack after school, put food in their bellies. And it's sad to say, but sometimes that's the last meal that those kids are going to eat until they see us the next morning before school. And then and during the summer times, our kids get a hot lunch every day at 1 o'clock Monday through Friday.
Besides flags, Morgan used some downtown Anchorage geography to stress hunger's grip within the city.
Right here in downtown Anchorage, it looks like we're standing in the middle of a beautiful park. But if you walk a couple blocks that way, you end up at New Hope on the Last Frontier, which runs a mobile food pantry on Thursday nights and a food pantry on Tuesday. Anybody here been there to the New Hope? Yeah. They serve approximately 150 families every week. Now, if you head that way a couple blocks, you end up at the Downtown Soup Kitchen, which provides a hot meal to folks every day.
When Morgan asked if any in the audience had been to the New Hope Food Pantry, she was not speaking to community volunteers. Her question was directed at the sizable group who personally face hunger and were drawn less to the ceremony than to the mobile food pantry truck parked nearby. According to Morgan, they represented the ever-growing number of people in the state needing food assistance. She says the shaky economy has reduced the amount of contributions coming from big stores like Cars Safeway and Fred Meyer's. That drop increases the need for more individual contributions. Morgan says on the positive side is a boost in government support. Alaska Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Bill Hogan announced that his department would again help fund the special Thanksgiving food distribution by giving $50,000 to the food bank. But at the same time, he also described the statewide growth of hunger.
Frankly, the number of households or number of families that have needed the food stamp program has grown dramatically. In the past year alone, we have 4,000 additional households who've signed up for food stamps.
Steve Brown of the University of Alaska's Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service described the continuing contributions of food made by Alaska's small but concerned agricultural community.
Over the past 5 years, the University of Alaska Fairbanks has donated on average 26,000 pounds of potatoes each year to the food bank. And that's just a small percentage compared to what other farmers in Alaska also donate to the food bank.
But with demand up 30% this year, Morgan says the food bank is struggling to meet statewide needs. Public awareness is crucial. So this month, the food bank is sponsoring a special event.
We are challenging folks to try and live on the amount of money they would get if they were on food stamps. It's about $2 a meal, maybe a little less per individual. So we're challenging folks to try and see what it's like to be one of these folks who needs food assistance and are really trying to make ends meet.
So far, about 30 people have signed up, including State Senator Johnny Ellis and his office staff, Senator Liesl McGuire, and Representative Lindsey Holmes. The challenge period runs from Saturday, September 12th through Friday, September 18th. This is Len Anderson.
The city of Sitka has hired a historic preservation consultant to update the community's preservation plan. The document, when completed, should qualify Sitka for a variety of federal and state matching grants for protecting its historic structures and landscape. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The request for proposals was drafted not in City Hall, but at the table of the Sitka Historic Preservation Commission. The commission wants to update the current historic preservation plan, a two-page document written 15 years ago. Peter Gorman is the chair.
Basically, it's a broad planning document that will address the community. There'll be public meetings, you know, what is important historically to the community. You get all that input. There'll be interviews with multiple people here to just get a basis of what's important here. Then there will be a kind of an inventory of the resources we have here, the historic resources, districts, maps.
The Assembly voted unanimously last week to approve the professional services contract and to contribute $10,000 to revising the plan. The money for the $25,000 project was budgeted last year. The commission received a state grant for the balance. Gorman is aware that most people identify Sitka's preservation needs with the historic structures in town, like the A&B Hall and the Sheldon Jackson campus. He says the commission is hoping for something more.
There's a whole other dimension, too, that I hope is addressed in this plan, and I certainly will stress, and that's our cultural landscapes. The location that we sit in here in Sitka, to the Tlingit peoples, to all the peoples here, the view sheds we have here, of looking out at Mount Edgecombe, which goes back in time to Indian River, the National Cemetery. These are referred to as cultural landscapes, the impacts of people on where we live. And this is as important to recognize and preserve as our built landscape.
not surprisingly, you may have a range of historic resources in a community, but not everybody values them all the same. There are different segments that care more strongly about different types of resources.
That's Debbie Abel, a historic preservation consultant based in Tempe, Arizona. She'll be visiting Sitka in the near future to do an initial assessment and then return two more times through next spring. Abel says an important part of preservation planning is identifying what a community wants to do and what it can do.
No historic preservation program can do everything that's on their plate. They just can't, you know, that are laid out. So you have to be able to pick and choose, and the successful way to do it is to pick those things that you're going to get most support from a larger audience for. And so that's what I'm hoping in this planning process I will do. We will end up with a series of recommendations as to what's important, how to proceed, what's missing, what do they need to find, that kind of thing. This is a very programmatic process.
Abel will prepare a document that complies with the Secretary of Interior's standards and guidelines, the federal preservation blueprint that communities must now have in order to tap into federal and state grant funding. But Abel says it's not just about the proper government speak. The planning process is a real opportunity to connect with what community members feel most strongly about. That's why she'll be in Sitka at least three times to sample community opinion. Without consulting residents, Abel says historic preservation planners are sometimes their own worst enemies.
Our criteria and how we decide significance and importance is very clearly laid out in the historic preservation word, but is oftentimes not explained in a manner that the general public understands. It's like, that's just an old building, but, you know, being able to explain why just an old building might be important.
Peter Gorman, who's been a ranger at Sitka National Historical Park and now works at the Sheldon Jackson Museum, suggests that Sitka's role in history cannot be understated. The community rests at the intersection of Native and Western cultures, a natural harbor with access to both the ocean and the Inside Passage, and all the resources contained in those environments. He stresses again that in a place like Sitka, place is a major part of preservation planning.
They refer to this as ethnographic landscapes, and they're formally recognized. So you would look at Herring Rock that we have here. That's part of an ethnographic landscape of Eastern Channel, where maybe back in, for the Tlingit peoples, they were collecting herring there. And you read some of Baranoff's early notes of 1805, and he saw 2,000 Tlingit peoples out in the near waters here in March. And he thought they were going to be attacked. And no, they were out there herring fishing.
Gorman anticipates that the Historic Preservation Commission will hold its first public meetings with the consultant in October. A final preservation plan should be ready by May of next year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports from Ed Ronco and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Sutton and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage. Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
And by
Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.